This is WBCR LP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 and streaming at berkshireradio.org. Stay tuned for a Farm and Garden show with Jay Allison Moscariello and Bill Taylor. We will discuss rhizophagy with mycologist and plant pathologist James White Jr., with whom we will discuss how plants use microbes for mutual benefit. This may change how we garden, farm, and even save seeds. The interview begins at around 10:05. First, some upcoming events and information on gardening and farming in these dry times.
Transform our ways, or we may not last. Take time to learn what ancestors teach us. Honor the spirit residing in that which feeds us. Act for the future of seven generations. And together we can share in this dance of life. Act for the future of seven generations.
Great Barrington Seed Library needs a coordinator to revive this community resource. Contact the Great Barrington Public Library at 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Great Barrington Farmers Market is Saturdays 9 to 1, 18 Church Street, now through November 12, 2022. New Marlborough will run Sundays 10 to 1 on the Green, now through October 9th. Sheffield is Friday 3 to 6 p.m., First Congregational Church, 125 Main Street through October 7th. Pittsfield is sponsored by Roots Rising every Saturday, rain or shine, from 9 to 1 through October 8th at Pittsfield Common, 100 First Street. West Stockbridge is 3 to 6 p.m. Thursdays at 1 Harris Street, Merritt Green, through October 6th. Lee will run Saturdays through October 8th in the Town Green, 25 Park Place in front of the Congregational Church. Lennox is Fridays 11 to 3 at 80 Church Street through September 30th. Otis is Saturday 9 to 1 at 2000 East Otis Road through October 8th. Copaic Hillsdale Farmers Market is Saturday 9 to 1 at 9140 Route 22, Hillsdale, New York, through November 19th. More on these and other farmers markets is at berkshiregrown.org. That's berkshiregrown.org. There's an autumn plant sale at the Berkshire Botanical Garden, Friday and Saturday, September 18th and 19th. There'll be presentation of the Harvest Workshop, also at the Botanical Garden, Sunday, October 4th. You can register for these and other events at berkshirebotanical.org. Finding Farmland in Berkshire County will be held October 19th from 5 to 7 p.m. It's a free event hosted by American Farmland Trust. Contact is Jamie Pittern, 413-240-4621, or Root Fern, R-O-O-T-F-E-R-N, at farmland.org. You can also go to the farmland.org/berkshire-farm-futures. Here are some ideas for gardening and farming as we move into the fall of a very, very dry year. For lawns, don't cut your grass at least until October, or leave it cut high if you must mow it. But the best thing is to let those fall wildflowers bloom to help pollinators and for honeybees to make it through the winter. You can use barrels, buckets, any receptacles to collect water off ungutted roofs. Rainwater is actually better quality than well or city water or spring water because it is a little more acidic and it's what the plants are used to receiving from the sky. Any garden areas should have as close to 100% plant coverage to keep soil biology fed and shaded. This also helps protect soil when there is too much rain. You may want to invest in a drip irrigation system if you can, but you still want to get squash leaves wet to mimic their native condition of afternoon showers. Don't water deciduous perennials from September on so they can harden off for the winter coming up. Tender new foliage will just freeze off. Enjoy the extra flavor of dry farm tomatoes and other fruits. We hope these ideas help you get through the rest of this dry season. Here's a little information on growing garlic. The best time to plant it is in October, and then mulch it deeply with shredded leaves or straw mulch. And you don't need to buy seed garlic. It is sometimes certified disease-free, but I've had no trouble using organic garlic and just planting cloves of varieties I like. I do like to select the biggest bulbs and the biggest cloves for planting, so I get bigger bulbs next year.
Today's guest is James F. White, Jr., and he's a professor of plant pathology. Dr. White obtained the MS in mycology and plant pathology from Auburn University in Alabama and the PhD in mycology from the University of Texas, Austin in 1987. Dr. White specializes in symbiosis research, particularly endophytic microbes. He's the author of more than 180 articles and author and editor of reference books on the biology, taxonomy, and phylogeny of fungal endophytes, including biotechnology of Acromonium endophytes of grasses, and many more. He and his students in his lab are exploring the diversity of endophytic microbes and the various impacts that they have had on host plants. He's right now the professor in the Department of Plant Biology at the School of Environmental and Biological Sciences at Rutgers. It's a pleasure to have you
yes,
on our
it is.
Show.
I'm glad to be here.
And
glad
I've seen your presentations, and I know they're more effective on video, so I think any listeners will be well advised to go look at some of the YouTubes and other ways that they can get this information visually. But we're going to do our best here on the radio because it's really wonderful information to get out.
It's fascinating. We have lots of questions. How did you get involved with this exciting research?
Well, believe it or not, I've been working on endophytes for 40 years.
Wow.
Along those lines. I was when I was an undergraduate at Auburn in Alabama, there was a project for endophyte work on endophytes in tall fescue grass for cattle. They produce some chemicals, alkaloids that affected cattle. And so there was a lot of interest then. And so that's when I got my start right there. And then I just moved through specific fungal endophytes that were in these grasses to other kinds of fungal endophytes. And then the last 10 years or so, we've moved out into bacterial endophytes also, and started looking at those and kind of developing the same methods that we used, or variations of the methods that we used for fungal endophytes, we use now for bacterial endophytes. We had to invent some methods for staining these bacterial endophytes. Much of the work that has been published and that I've talked about comes out of that, the bacterial endophyte work.
And that has to be a really delicate process. This isn't one of my questions, but, you know, finding the right stains that aren't going to injure your processes, you know.
Well, we essentially had to invent them.
Wow.
We had to invent the stains. You could envision how we did it if I describe, you know, we'd go and get reagents from the laboratory shelf that affected various compounds that we thought these endophytes might be producing. And then we started using those and working in up to nitrate stains and ethylene hormone stains and so forth. I mean, it seems like it's only a microscope and you stain some stuff and look at it, but actually there's quite a bit of innovation that comes in to doing that. And that's why no one has done it before, is because they didn't have the tools to do it. In fact, if you look at plant cells, if you just make a slide of, say, some plant tissue and look at it, you don't see, it looks like just cells. You know, you don't really see bacteria in there. But once you start looking at them with the right stain, looking at the chemicals being produced by these microbes and or by the plants in response to the microbes, then you can see these microbes in there. So it's a matter of making what was invisible visible. And
well,
so that's where we're at.
That was what's so fantastic about looking at your slides, because I've always liked having a microscope when I was a kid, but I didn't have all the stains and things, obviously, and I wasn't doing what you were doing. However, when I got to see your slides and see how you would use that stain, I could just see that activity, and it was so exciting. I mean, I could see the outline of the cells. I could see the interaction of these wonderful microbes running around. It was wonderful. Very, very exciting.
There are one big area that we work in is the area of how plants get nutrients from microbes. Okay, that's the big area. And the bottom line is they get a lot of nutrients from microbes that they take in and turn them into endophytes. And these are microbes that go endo, internal, fight, plant. Basically, these are microbes that go inside plants and plant tissues. And how they get nutrients from those microbes is what this work that we're doing is revealing, you know, trying to sort out the how they get those nutrients. There is this process. There are two processes. One of them is simply nitrogen fixation, right? And these microbes can fix nitrogen from the air and plants cannot. And so plants have developed ways to capture these microbes from the environment, from the soils, because they take them out of the soils, put them into their tissues, and then they coax or extract nutrients out of them. And so in terms of nutrients from the soils, iron and molybdenum and manganese and magnesium and nitrogen and phosphorus, potassium, you know, these basic nutrients that plants need, the plants will attract the microbes from the soil that carry those nutrients, and they'll internalize them into the root cells. And this happens really at the growing root tips. So they're producing exudates out of those tips, and those exudates that are made of sugars and sometimes amino acids, sometimes organic acids, those exudates are really attracting these bacteria or microbes, because yeasts also can be involved. Some fungi are involved in this process.
And the mix of exudates they use, does that select certain bacteria species? Are they that much intelligence with the plant, or are they putting all this different stuff out and getting everybody?
The honest truth is everything is not clear yet, but it does look like plants, it's known that they change the exudates that they secrete based on nutrients that they need. You know, so you would infer from that knowledge, those experiments that showed that, you would infer from that that plants are somehow electing the microbes that will carry the nutrients that they need, right? Somehow they're, you know, and we don't know, we don't really know how. You know, there's lots of deep, you think of the genetics of all of this, and it's very complicated, right? I mean, we don't know. Right. I won't go into what we don't know. We don't know a lot, right? We don't know a lot. We don't know an awful lot. But yeah, they appear to select which microbes they bring in. They attract them by the exudates to the root tip, and then they internalize them into those root cells. Then once they're internalized, the plant will extract nutrients from them. And they extract the nutrients from them by secreting superoxide onto the microbes. Superoxide is this really potent form of reactive oxygen. It's potent, it's very powerful, but it's short-lived. It doesn't last very long. So it's almost like for ideal for close work inside the cell, because the superoxide will hit the microbes, extract nutrients out of them, and then you don't have a lot of superoxide that hangs around inside the cell to do damage to the plant cell itself. But plant cells are also tougher than bacterial cells. The plant cells have sterols in the membranes, and these bacteria don't. So bacteria are more vulnerable to this superoxide.
Now, is superoxide just straight oxygen, or is it a compound? In the formulas on your slides, it just says, I think it's O or O minus.
With a negative charge.
Right.
So it's a radical, a so-called reactive oxygen species, right? ROS. We always use the acronym ROS. Well, that means it's just oxygen that's potent, oxidizing form of oxygen. It's got an electron, a free radical, right? That'll zap things. And so that's what's happening here. That's how plants are using oxygen. And in fact, they get that oxygen. They get that oxygen from the air, right? Mm-hmm. To produce that superoxide, they hit the microbes that are inside their root cells then with that superoxide that takes the cell walls off of the bacteria, and some of the nutrients are in those cell walls. So the bacteria lose their cell walls and the plant gets all those nutrients there. There's metals and protein and all kinds of stuff hanging on these bacterial cell walls. And we can actually see the cell walls go into the root cells. So we have images. Yeah, no, it's really cool. I'm resisting going to photos to show you, but the point is,
I want to see.
I know, but I worry about my descriptions may leave something to be desired if I start referring to the photos. So anyways, they extract nutrients out of those microbes, and you can see those in online presentations. Okay. Then what happens is the surviving microbes will actually trigger root hair formation. Okay, so not all the microbes are broken down. Some microbes, in fact, are replicated and increase when they go inside the cell. And these are the ones that are adapted, seem to be most adapted to the plant. So they then go into these root hairs and or the root hair initials, and then they will trigger the root hairs to grow. If we don't have those bacteria there inside those root cells, we have no root hairs forming at all. You just see these naked roots. And plant development doesn't happen very well at all because the plants aren't getting nutrients. These bacteria are also producing hormones. They're producing ethylene, and they're also producing nitric oxide. And both of those are plant hormones, and they trigger root hair elongation. This is something important for nitrogen fixation. The nitric oxide is thought to be produced by the bacteria as an antioxidant. It's because the plant is producing superoxide. And so the bacteria, in order to survive, needs to produce something that's going to counteract that superoxide.
Yes.
And so they produce nitric oxide or other forms of nitrogen. There could even be some ammonium in there that will combine them with superoxide. And then you have nitrate forming, and then the plants can absorb that nitrate. So there is nitrogen fixation. And this happens actually as those root hairs are elongating. There's phases in which bacteria are ejected from the root hair, and then some remain, and then they're replicated again. And we think that's where nitrogen fixation happens. And then they're ejected again in mass. They'll accumulate in the tips of those root hairs. And then they're going to be ejected back into the soil and can acquire more nutrients later to be attracted back to the tip. So you have this constant cycle, and we call that the rhizophagy. Rhizophagy, rhizo for root, phagy for eating, root eating. And this is the idea that plant roots are eating microbes or consuming microbes as a source of nutrients. And all the work that we have bears out. It's actually difficult to decide exactly which nutrients are coming from absorption, right, in the soil nutrient solution versus those that are actually oxidized from bacteria. But we have some ways of testing that. And we have some ideas about which nutrients are more important based on those kind of studies that we've done.
So I have a quick question about that. You were talking about how the cells get recycled. You know, they get pushed out, they collect nutrients, they come back in. Just out of curiosity, do you have any information about how long that microbe cycle is? How long it can actually live going back and forth?
Yeah, we do.
Is that a dumb question?
We can see. Yeah, it's not a dumb question. No, it's a good question. It's a frequent question that people have. How long is the rhizophagy cycle? Well, I mean, I can tell you, if you germinate a seed, for example, any kind of seed, the root comes out and then you begin to see root hairs.
Right.
However long that period is between the emergence of that root radical from the seed and the time you see hairs starting to form, that is the length of the rhizophagy cycle. So as soon as hairs form, they're being ejected from the... Now there is a period, you say an indefinite period, in which the microbes go out into the soil. So how long before they're then attracted? That I can't say, but more than likely, they're immediately engaged. Once they're ejected, the tip is already way down there in the soil by then, right? A day or so growth. And so they can then acquire new nutrients and go through the soil back. And so you can have this constant like that. Of course, some of them may not go back. Some of them may go out to the soil and disappear, but that doesn't, more than likely not. More than likely, they can capture most of those microbes.
And they have to rebuild their cell walls, because my understanding is that when they're stripped, they're called protoplasts, which is like a cell without a cell wall. Once they're put back out, they have to rebuild that cell wall, which is made out of nutrients that the plant will use when it brings it back in, if it brings that particular one back in.
It is this. When those microbes are inside the cells, after they lose their cell walls, they're these naked protoplasts, right? Without cell walls, or maybe with some minimal wall material hanging on. And these protoplasts are replicated very rapidly inside. And so the plant, in moving these microbes around in these hairs, they actually will, the plant will actually circulate them inside these root cells. And so they'll go around and around, around like that until there's an ejection, and then they'll be ejected out. Some of them will be ejected out, and then others will remain in, and they'll cycle around and replicate it until you get a bunch. So you have a lot of them being formed, but they're still protoplasts while they're inside. When they're ejected, when those root hairs grow, they're ejected at every growth spurt. And that's every 20 minutes or an hour or something like that. There's a new growth spurt and there's ejection of bacteria. Mm. But when these microbes are ejected from the tips of the root hairs. As those root hairs are growing, they go out of little holes in the tips. Mm-hmm. When they're ejected, the plant puts some more exudates out with them.
Oh.
And we can see them growing and reforming their cell walls at that tip.
Yeah, wow. Fascinating.
Wow.
Yeah, they really are farming these guys. They are protecting them. They're taking care of them. They're giving them food to take.
Isn't it crazy? Isn't that crazy stuff? Crazy stuff.
We're talking with Professor James White here on WBCRLP. He's a microbiologist and a
plant pathologist,
all kinds of things.
A lot of things.
Things you need to know to master this subject.
This is totally off in left field. You can actually see how we've evolved from this very small cell because we're doing the same things.
You can. We're very simple. Like, for example, the human gut is essentially our equivalent of the plant root. Now, I don't know if there's any rhizophagy in the human gut. Now, we have a lot of unknown there with the human microbiome as well. We can grow our plants where we can look at the roots. So that's the gut equivalent of the plant, right? We can look at those roots and we can see the bacteria in there with the human gut. I mean, it's very difficult to open the human gut up and study it under a microscope like that. Not a living gut anyways.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when the superoxide dissolves the cell walls, does it also consume some of the entire bacteria?
Well, I mean, you can imagine how this works. If a microbe is able to produce enough of these antioxidant nitrogen compounds, whatever will combine with superoxide, right? If it can produce enough of that, then it can save itself and survive in this internal, highly oxidative system inside the plant cell. But if it's unable to do that, it will be consumed in its entirety and nothing left. So you can see how the plant would then select for those microbes that can benefit it the most, which are the ones that are going to be secreting out nitrogen, right? And so they could get these that could secrete out nitrogen. Other kinds of antioxidants also can go into that question, and these microbes can survive. But in order for the plant to grow and thrive, the ones that secrete nitrogen are going to be the ones that are selected for and extracted and taken in and then put back out into the soil. So that those ones then that work with the plant are the ones that the plant increases, right, around the soil. But I have to add, that's rhizophagy, right? This is a process in the soil where plants are eating microbes. Okay, yes, I mean, essentially they're eating microbes in a form and degrading, extracting nutrients from them. That is definitely happening. And these provide a lot of different kinds of nutrients for plants in soils. Phosphorus, potassium, you name it, nitrogen, all the metals, all of that. But there is another process that plants do. And not just the root process, not just rhizophagy, but they have also in their leaves and in the growing shoots, they will also cultivate microbes that they will then extract nitrogen from. For example, if you consider other kinds of plant hairs called trichomes, and these trichomes are, you know, many plants will have trichomes on the leaves or on the flowering organs, wherever development is happening in the plant, you know, there'll be some trichomes. And plants will take some of the best microbes that it acquired from soil and then put those microbes in those trichomes, in those hairs on the leaves and the flowers and the parts and the fruit.
So they'll move it up their stem. They'll move it up their system.
They do, no doubt about it. They will cultivate these microbes at the meristematic zones on the root tip, but also on the shoot tip, right? In those areas, also in the inflorescence, flowers, whatever it is. These trichomes are filled with these microbes. And you see, what you see there is these oxidative interactions again and nitrate forming in those trichomes. In fact, if you look at something like, consider a plant like cannabis, hemp, the glandular trichomes in hemp actually are filled with bacteria and they are producing nitrogen. And we can see that with our stains because those glandular trichomes, you can see the bacteria in there, but the glandular trichomes, the whole trichome becomes stained for nitrate because of that nitrate accumulating in there. In fact, we think the chemicals in hemp, the THC and the other cannabinoids and other terpenoids, We think those are antioxidant or oxygen scavenging. They play an oxygen scavenging role because nitrogen fixation is inhibited by oxygen. So that's why you have a lot of nitrogen fixation in nodules, right? In root nodules and legumes. They can limit oxygen in there and you get a lot of fixation. So we think the same thing is happening in these glandular trichomes of cannabis.
Do you think that's why they attribute the ability to reduce tumors to the THC or the cannabinoids because of their antioxidants?
So yes, I can't make that connection, but that's exactly the kind of connection that I would try to make. Mm-hmm. Because we can go into the medical literature and you can get clues to how these cannabinoids are actually working on a molecular level. We think they're anti-insect or they screw up the brains of the insect. This is the theories, right, of how those cannabinoids work. But we think that that might only be partially correct.
But well, the take home for farming is, you know, I was told for years, you've got to have legumes in your cover crop. The only way plants can get nitrogen is through nitrogen fixation on nodules. And your research has just totally blown that myth apart.
It is not true that that's the only place plants get. We know we can grow legumes and they have these nodules and we can turn those into the soil and get nitrogen, or just growing them will result in some more nitrogen coming out of the plant. But pretty much all plants have endophytes, all non-cultivated plants. In some of our cultivated plants, we've destroyed these endophytic systems. You know, certainly anything that's gone through tissue culture, anything that's been treated with a lot of nitrogen fertilizer over time will have had some damage to these endophytic systems in plants. In fact, if we do tissue culture, I have a colleague here who works with me, a tissue culturist. She does a lot of tissue culture. And I look at one of her African violet plants, expecting to perhaps see some endophytes in there in those trichomes. And they were totally empty. They didn't have any bacteria in them at all, those tissue cultured plants. So we knock these systems out, whereas every wild plant, any wild plant we look at, has these microbes in their tissues. And they provide this nitrogen to plants as they grow. They're easily knocked out. I'm consider corn. I have a friend, also a collaborator, named Walter Goldstein at the Mondawmin Institute in Wisconsin, who's an organic corn breeder. And he's been trying to breed nitrogen-fixing corn. And so what he did was took some varieties from, in this case, Peru, one called Piracinco, that is one of these land races that doesn't require nitrogen. And then we compared that to some modern sweet corn. And what we found is that the Piracinco has in its tissues, it has lots of trichomes, for one thing, on the plant, on the leaves, and also on the cob leaves, around the cob.
Mm.
And in it, when we look at the bacteria, we see these huge masses of bacteria in these nitrogen fixers or nitrogen efficient corn. And so what Walter Goldstein has been trying to do is to take these endophytes that we have in these nitrogen fixing corns, mm-hmm. corn, and move them over into other corn varieties to establish organic corn.
Wow.
So that you don't have to put nitrogen on them at all, or any other nutrients for that matter, as far as I know.
That brings me to a question, something to do with micronutrients.
I can tell you about the micronutrients. So one thing that we're seeing about rhizophagy, we haven't measured nutrients in a lot of plants, but to find out which ones are oxidatively extracted, we do a special kind of experiment where we will elevate the carbon dioxide in an environment, in a chamber where we grow plants. And the carbon dioxide will actually suppress superoxide formation by the plant. We can see that we elevate the carbon dioxide. I mean, this is mm-hmm. like high elevation, right? This is saturated CO2. This is not like they push crops with a little bit, 1,000 part per million or 11 part per million. This is like much higher parts per million. And when we do that, we see we can suppress the superoxide around the bacteria. And what that does is it suppresses extraction of nutrients from those bacteria. And what we see is that we have, most of them will fall. We'll get reductions in most nutrients, but the micronutrients like manganese and iron and magnesium and so forth, various, many, many micronutrients, right? Several micronutrients are actually reduced significantly. So we think that this oxidative extraction using the superoxide is really necessary to get these micronutrients for plants. And so, I mean, you can do a similar experiment, actually. You've done it many times, I'm sure. If you have any flooded areas or areas in your field where you don't have good aeration, then the plants can't get superoxide. If they can't get that oxygen out of the air, they can't extract nutrients from microbes. And what you see is plants suffer nutritionally if you don't have good aeration. And we think it's because we're inhibiting this rhizopagia cycle in plant roots.
Yeah. The question I had about micronutrients was, it's the balance of minerals. There's the camp that says you've got to get the balance of minerals right in the soil to have optimal crop production. And people like Elaine Ingham say, only in rare cases is that true. In most soils, it's the biology that really wins. And I'm just wondering where you come down on that. I know a lot of your experiments have been in controlled experiments, but out in the field, the variation in nutrients in the soil.
I actually think Elaine Ingham is correct. That's what we think. We think that the plant is in control of the system. And of course, this is the system. If plants have all the microbes they need, they will select which ones depending on what nutrients they need. I mean, that's how we think this thing is working. So to what extent, if you destroy a soil with deep turning and lots of fertilizer applications and applications of all kinds of other agrochemicals to the soils, you know, you've damaged it and no longer a living soil. And if you take a plant and you damage it as well, like, for example, you try to grow a modern sweet corn on a damaged soil, then you have no real microbial benefit, right? And so whatever nutrients are there is what nutrients they take. But if you create a living soil with a healthy plant where you're at least not suppressing microbes and not suppressing rhizophagy cycle, not suppressing nitrogen fixation by squirting nitrogen on plants or anything like that, then you're going to have the plants essentially self-regulating and picking the nutrients, self-growing, excluding toxic or not taking in toxic. At least they're managing the microbes, and that should manage the nutrients that the plants need. In fact, they're in control of that whole process. So I agree with Elaine Ingham. These plants can manage that if they have the microbes. It's biology related. Yeah.
Now, there's the idea that if you keep growing crops for over and over again on the soil, you're going to take all the nutrients out and play it out. But it may be that instead you're over time degrading, plowing, disturbing, that you may be disturbing the biological cycle. Because it seems to me that even if you have rock material, that fungi can dissolve some of that rock material and you're constantly replenishing the minerals. I'm kind of wondering about that, and that is sort of a lead into the role of fungi in this system, whether there's a role of them in the rhizophagy. And I think in one of your presentations, you said the fungi go to a different part of the root than the tip, but sometimes they also act as highways. So sometimes they're involved and sometimes they're not. So maybe speak a little bit about fungi.
Yeah. Okay. So everybody knows about mycorrhizae, right? Fungi that go into roots. It's well known. And in fact, I'm a mycologist, so I know about mycorrhizae too. So you see them in older parts of roots where they connect with the root. Now, they may be entering roots before they fully mature, but they do go in older parts of roots and they connect. And so there's this continuous connection out with the soil to the root and continual nutrient flow and so forth. And in fact, many of these mycorrhizae will also host bacteria that go inside the hyphae. Believe it or not, VA mycorrhizae will go in there. And others, some of the bacteria will also go on the surface of the hyphae. So you have the so-called mycorrhizal superhighway, right? Or fungal superhighway, whatever you want for bacteria, for plant microbes that can go there and go to the root. Okay, so that's probably pretty important for plants. It's another way, it's another connection with the biology that enables those bacteria to get there. Some fungi, though, that even are non-mycorrhizal, will, just like these bacteria, will be taken into the root cells. And so we have some plants that look like they're dominated with fungal endophyte that goes into the root cells and also is ejected out the root hair tip. So they go into the rhizophagy cycle. There's a lot we still don't know. You know, are those important for nutrients? Can the plant really get those nutrients out of those fungi? Because the fungi are eukaryotes, like plants. You know, they may be tougher. You know, so the plant, we don't know if the plant can get nutrients out of them so far, but we do know they go in And we do know they'll go all the way through the process. They go in at the tip and go out at the root hair tip.
Now, it's said that mycorrhizal fungi go more with woody plants, trees, you know, more perennial type plants, and less with some of your annuals like kale and the brassicas and the beet family. And I'm wondering if the other type of fungi also have a preference, or if they're found in all plants, the non-mycorrhizal fungi.
They tend to be, there's different kinds of mycorrhizae, right? I mean, the big trees, for example, the trees, they developed a way to get ectomycorrhizae and different, well, and also endomycorrhizae to get nutrients. Especially a lot of the trees have ectomycorrhizae, which basically the whole root is covered with fungi. And there are different kinds of fungi there. There are fungi that are ascomycetes, you know, they have certain features there. There are fungi that are basidiomycetes, that roots. There are also mucor type endophytes. So there's different kinds. And so it's hard to say a generalization about it, but you did mention that some plants don't tend to have many mycorrhizae at all, right? And things like Brassicaceae, it's not a 100% to say they don't have. You know, I mean, sometimes you'll see mycorrhizae coming on those plants, but those plants, in particular, the Brassicaceae, they may not have a lot of mycorrhizae, but they do have a lot of bacteria. It is curious when you examine Brassicaceae, the extent to which bacteria are active inside those plant cells. We can actually see them swimming around in the cells. They're moving around in there, and you can see them sometimes when they you can break a cell and they come out. So Brassicaceae tend to be very highly bacterial dominated, and you tend not to see any kind of fungal mycorrhizal association. There are some others like sedges that inhabit areas that tend to be flooded. Sedges, for example, I mean, they tend to be, you know, waterlogged soils. The waterlogging prevents mycorrhizae from growing around those roots. And so you have, because there's no oxygen, fungi are aerobic, right? They have to have oxygen. So if you limit that oxygen, you don't get mycorrhizal fungi. So there's different reasons why. With Brassicaceae, the bacteria in there are so abundant that they may be suppressing any fungal colonization by colonizing the fungi and sapping them of nutrients, essentially taking nutrients from the fungi and moving it over into the plant. But the fungi, mycorrhizae, don't tend to colonize those plants. Okay, so that's one thing. But many plants will have both bacteria and fungal endosymbionts in their, in their tissues. Yeah.
And it could be, I think it's probably true that the brassicas get all of their nutrients from the bacteria. They don't need to have.
Yeah. No, that's right. That's right. They probably don't need it. They have so many bacteria that they're utilizing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they probably don't need it. That's what we think. Now, there's other differences. We don't know, for example, how microbes associate with plants. And so there may be some gene interactions, some interactions that are happening in addition to what I'm talking about.
Right.
But the big picture is the Brassicaceae are highly reliant on their bacteria in all their cells. And so that probably limits any colonization of fungi.
There's a debate between doing monocultures and doing polycultures, multiple plants in a bed. And I'm starting to move away from polycultures that include brassicas because it seems like they stifle onions and some other things' growth. Maybe I get as much harvest out of a bed with multiple species if I'm able to harvest them all than if I had one species. But there seem to be a lot of cases where, you know, it's a great squash here, but the squash that are in on my multiple species beds are not always doing that great. So
we would call that allelopathy, right?
Exactly.
Where one plant inhibits the growth of another plant. But the question that we discovered that there's a similar phenomenon that happens with microbes. And that is some plants have microbes that inhibit other plants. And what will happen is these microbes will go. In fact, we did a patent. We have a big project, actually, to try to develop a bioherbicide. So one of our patents relates to using those bacteria as a bioherbicide to inhibit competitor plants. So, for example, we could take a microbe out of tomato and we could give it to another plant and it will inhibit that other plant. It'll go inside the other plant in the root, and then it will be so resistant oxidatively that the root, the plant can't control it. And then it doesn't grow, right? So our idea there was, well, we could possibly use this in a bioherbicide, because, you know, there's a big race right now on the planet Earth to try to develop bioherbicides to get away from some of the toxic agrochemicals, harmless bioherbicides. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so us and a lot of other companies and universities are all trying to develop organic bioherbicides. So anyways, we got a big program where we're trying to do that. Yeah, so, okay. So the question is, with your inhibition, right, your allelopathy, right, is that because of the microbes that Brassicaceae have and they're so rich with, or is that because of some chemicals? And it could be either at this point. We don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would raise the point, the hypothesis that it might be the microbes coming out of those plants, of the brassicas that are moving and inhibiting the other plants, going and interfering. We actually made a fancy name for that. Endobiome interference, we call it. Endobiome interference. Endo, to go in, right? Biome, in the biome of the plant, go into the plant and interfere with the functioning of that biome or microbiome. So it doesn't work right. So the plant doesn't work right. So that was the term we developed for that. But I mean, it's just a word, right? I mean, basically the plant can't handle it, those microbes, and can't grow properly with them. So our idea is to incorporate that into an overall bioherbicide that can be used safely in gardens and in agricultural tools. Well, a lot of people are doing it. Right? It's a big target, right? It's because we know it's important. Yes. And so a lot of people are working on this. And, you know, we may or may not end up with the best product out there or the product that replaces other kinds of herbicides, but it's part of an effort that you see worldwide that something is going to come out of it. And so, I mean, my prediction is that in the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to see a lot of these organic bioherbicides much safer coming into the market, and the tools for growing plants regeneratively or organically are going to increase.
So we're speaking with Professor James White of Rutgers University here on WBCRLP about rhizophagy and many interesting topics that could change the way gardeners work. And there's sort of two more topics that we'd like to talk about is hydroponics briefly, and then seed saving and what different methods of saving seeds and treating seeds pre-plant that were done by the Native Americans that Jay was referring to before. So we want to talk about all that. So maybe just briefly, hydroponics. Are there bacteria in hydroponic systems? Are there fungi in hydroponic systems? How different is it than soil? And because they're allowing hydroponics to be used in organic agriculture, and that's kind of a controversial topic too.
It's kind of, well, obviously, plants aren't designed to grow in liquid, right? They're designed for the most part. I mean,
except Venus flytraps.
Venus flytrap plants that grow in flooded areas, you know, things like, or plants that float around, bladder warts, you know, floating around in water all the time like that. So hydroponics, they're not designed for that. It does work. People do it. And there are products to put onto plants that may have some effect. I do have a graduate student looking into this question, and he is seeing effects. There's some stimulation of growth. I don't recall right now what else is going on. We would anticipate that there is going to be, depending on how you do it, what the microbes are, where you put the microbes, there's also going to be oxidative tolerance. So you could, if you do it right, you could increase your hardiness of the plants by putting microbes on it where they don't have it already. But most of the nutrients are going to be coming dissolved in the liquid. And so you're not going to get the big benefits that you get when you have soil environment where you have lots of. Now, aeroponic might be different. Aeroponics, where you get just spray coming up, you know, so that would be kind of a different. You have a lot of air exposed to the roots different times. You may be able to get nitrogen fixation and so forth happening in these aeroponic systems. My student is looking at that. There also are companies that are working on that.
And then seed saving, right?
Seed saving, we wanted to talk about that.
Yeah.
Because when we're saving our seeds, are we doing damage to them? What is the best way that you would imagine to take care of the seeds so that they are better capable of doing all these processes when we put them in the soil? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thought is that just the fact that we are pulling seeds when they're mature or maybe even prematurity, right? Because oftentimes seeds will fall off when they're fully mature. We're taking them before they're fully mature, and then we're storing them in a cool, dry place. And what we're doing when we do that is we are reducing the growth or the maturation of the microbiome on those seeds. And typically what will happen in nature is that a seed will stay in a moist environment. It may fall to the ground when it's mature. Soil microbes may colonize it. So you get much more complete microbiome development in a natural situation where we're not trying to save the seeds, right? This is a wild plant in nature, right?
Right.
But we take them, pull them early before the microbiome is fully developed. We put them in a place where it's dry and the microbes can't grow and they don't develop. And then when we plant those, the seeds don't immediately have those microbes on them. And so they've lost some microbes. In fact, there's been experiments there was an experiment done in Utah where they looked at it. It was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences back in, I'm forgetting when, 2010 or maybe something like that. They looked at this wild tobacco, annual tobacco that they brought in, and they started cultivating it, brought it into cultivation experimentally. And what they found was that as they cultivated this wild tobacco, after about 7 years, they started getting bad disease happening in the plots. And they went back and they looked at the wild plants, and then they isolated microbes from it, and they found that there's some bacteria and some fungi on those wild seeds they didn't have in their cultivated. After 4 years, they'd lost those microbes.
Oh.
Just the process of getting in. So then they took those microbes from the wild tobacco, put it back on the cultivated where they were cultivating it, and the diseases went away. So, I mean, it's clear that just the process of domestication, right? Trying to make a crop, we're losing some microbes. And those microbes, I mean, those could be important microbes, whichever the crop is, that would be important for controlling disease, that would be important for nutrients and so forth. So when you save seed, and I can't tell you how to do it, but the best way I would think would be to treat those seed so that it mimics nature as much as possible. So, okay. I mean, I'd say if you stored seed with a little soil in there, you know, it depends on the system, you know, what you can do. But I mean, you could experiment with ways to perhaps store seed for a year for the next season with microbes there, right? Maybe in a little bit moisture environment instead of totally dry, and trying to encourage microbial growth.
That sounds like a
good idea. But you have to keep them cold over the winter. You can't store them inside or they'll start growing the wrong time, right?
Right, right.
I mean, in our climate here. In a northern...
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, you'd have to play with it and see what it was necessary to, what you'd have to do to keep it going. Typically, plants on the East Coast, you know, we got a lot of moisture around, you know, some of the warm season plants, you know, they'll just go totally dormant. They're not going to germinate for a long time. Cool season plants that grow well in the cool time, they'll germinate immediately.
Right.
And may grow for a while before you even see them, or just as a seedling, say planting grass or something in the yard.
Now, tomatoes are often, you're told to rot, sort of let it make a fungal mess for a few days and then save the seed. And I've always just take the seed out and save it and put it on paper and then grow it the next year. And it seems to do okay. But I wonder if that's better to let the tomato rot a little bit. And it's supposed to take something off the seed coat or something, but I don't know if that you want that. But
It works. Does it improve germination?
Maybe it improves germination, but I get plenty of germination the way I do it.
Yeah, I know we do too.
But you don't put them in the jar and let them get moldy, right? You just
well, What? Oh, I'll tell you what. I mean, that's not a terrible way. Let them rot and then grow them. That's not a terrible way to do it. That's not a bad way to do it. I mean, because at least you're not inhibiting microbes, right?
Right.
What people normally do with tomato industrially is they'll just ferment it. And ferment big batches of tomato and get the seeds, get everything else to rot away.
Right. That's what I'm talking about. That's how
get the seed. Oh, and get the seeds. Yeah. Well, that does affect microbes. You know, how do tomato seeds normally work, right? When you think about it, you think about what are these? These are giant berries. These are berries, you know, you're looking at nightshades, right? These are These are nightshades that we've selected and gotten big so that we can have a lot to eat when we eat them. But they naturally are animal or bird vectored. And birds will come or animals will come and eat those fruits and they'll go through the gut and they'll go through the feces and they'll germinate there. And so those plants that are vectored in that way may be picking up microbes from animal guts. And so we see, for example, with tomato, we see that a lot of the microbes in tomatoes, a lot of these endophytes that we're seeing are actually gut microbes. And they're adapted. They're in things like we've gotten E. coli out and staphylococcus and micrococcus and other things out of tomato. So that's the natural system, right? So our system of taking those tomatoes and fermenting them will kill some microbes that we would not necessarily kill when it goes through the gut, the human gut or the animal gut, right? That's a totally different system in nature. So, I mean, ideally, an experiment that could be done would be to feed your tomatoes to some animal and collect the seeds from the feces and then germinate that. It's kind of crazy. It would be something worth trying, right?
So maybe the bear is eating our tomatoes won't be a bad thing.
No, the bear is probably an ideal natural vector for seeds like tomato seeds, you know, as opposed to some grazer, right? That has a rumen where This is similar to mammals that don't have rumens, you know,
So there are two native methods. Jay mentioned
one. Okay, but now I'm thinking we're going to be collecting all the bear poop I see and burying it because, you know, there's always berries in there. There's always seeds in there. I want to do a patch now, I think. I want to do a patch in the back of the garden.
Right. Well, all of this stuff, I'll tell you, you already are clear of this, but I'm learning also as we go along. And I tell you, people are exploring ways to grow crops regeneratively. And there are approaches, regenerative approaches to growing crops and lots of creative things. I know of companies and that are trying to push crops, you know, without using a lot of agrochemicals. And they're doing some very creative, like foliar, you know, using algae to put on leaves and which has major effects on the plant. And so forth. So they're doing all kinds of interesting things to grow crops regeneratively. So the experimentation that's necessary for people to learn how to grow plants regeneratively or biologically, it's a massive amount of experimentation that we're going to have to do. And it's not just one person or one group that's doing it, right? Everybody is trying. Everyone who goes into this area, many, many people are exploring. Farmers, growers are exploring ways that they can do it. And companies are developing their techniques. And individuals are developing their techniques and learning from one another. So, I mean, I think that things that seem crazy, you know, like processing seeds through a mammal, may not be so crazy in a few years. That may not be crazy. A way to get microbes on seeds and restore the microbiome on plants.
Now, it's a different part of the body, but Jay mentioned a Russian woman was putting the seeds in her mouth before planting them to get some kind of microbes on them, and I thought that was interesting. And then I want you to talk very briefly, because we don't have a lot of time left.
And thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time. About the corn medicine, the Cherokee corn medicine.
Yeah. What the Iroquois did back in the 1800s, maybe before, they had something they called corn medicine. And it's actually in a book, Foods of the Iroquois, something like that. It mentions this, the Iroquois corn medicine, also the written in the 1800s or early 1900s. There also was another book referring to the holy man, the Iroquois holy man, medicine man called Handsome Lake. And the Handsome Lake was a prophet, but he described in writings about this corn medicine. And what he described is basically inoculating bacteria onto corn. And what the Iroquois would do with this corn medicine is they would go out and they would get wild grasses like Elymas, Canada wild rye, or Phragmites, the native Phragmites, you know, get those roots, and they would bring them back. They would put them in a pile of water, warm up the water a little bit, scrape off the roots into the, cut up the roots into the water. And then they would take their corn seed and they would partially germinate. They would germinate it inside the water. And then they would take that and move that to their corn fields, their mounds with the Three Sisters agriculture, whatever it was. But what they were doing was they were getting bacteria from those roots. And of course, wild plants have lots of bacteria in them, right? Especially in wild situations. So they took those from the wild grasses, put it on their corn, germinate it. The root starts to come out and the bacteria colonize it. Then they plant that and then the corn grows better. And of course, it was to them, they called it corn medicine. It was magic, right? But to us, that process is a process of microbiome transfer from those wild grasses into the water, over into their corn. And of course, I mean, we think of the indigenous Americans as doing the best regenerative agriculture possible, but they still had cultivated corn. And don't forget how they cultivate their corn. They take it every year. They get their best seed. They'd hang it up and dry it, right? Mm-hmm. And reduce colonization of other microbes. So the process of treatment by the indigenous Americans, so taking the seed and drying them, caused the loss of some of those microbes. So they were actively putting them back on their corn crops. Mm-hmm. So they were essentially using biostimulant microbes the way we would, but actually better, because what we tend to do is we tend to isolate the microbes, and we may develop a consortium of six or seven different microbes that people wouldn't use to put on their crops. They did microbes that may or may not be culturable. And it may be more than a little consortium. It could be many, many microbes. Whatever it was in those roots that could colonize the corn, it did, right? It was in a way better than our modern approach to doing it, because they had more microbes, even mm-hmm. microbes that may not be culturable, they were putting on their corn.
Mm. Well, this whole thing has been really fascinating. Yes. We need to wrap up. We need to get some contact information for you.
I'm at Rutgers University in the Department of Plant Biology. And my email, you can find my Rutgers mail with no problem. You can go to the Rutgers Plant Biology website and find my email there. My Gmail is jwhite, J-W-H-I-T-E, then the numbers 3728 at gmail.com. I'm happy to answer any questions if anyone has any
Great.
Questions.
That's jwhite3728@gmail.com. And if you look up James White rhizophagy,
there's some amazing,
there's some great,
amazing,
lot of YouTube talks have recorded that have pictures.
Slides that are fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us. We really, really appreciate it, because it is fascinating. And as you say, we're constantly learning. And this is just great, great information.
You're so welcome. It was my pleasure. Happy to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Okay.
This has been a Farm and Garden Show with hosts Bill Taylor and J. Allison Moscariello, and our guest, Dr. James White of Rutgers University. You can become a member of this station or make a donation of any amount to support community radio in the Berkshires through the website berkshireradio.org, or mail a check to Berkshire Community Radio Alliance, P.O. Box 152, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, 01230. Also on the website is an application to host your own program if that interests you.
Again, that's berkshireradio.org. This is WBCR LP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org.